looking at. The man's face was ridged down one side with the livid scars of a bad burn, and the twisted eyelid on that side exposed the milky lens of a blind eye. Had I needed any further confirmation that here stood the one-eyed seaman young Ian had thought he'd killed? Lank brown hair grew back from a balding brow to a scrawny pigtail that drooped over one shoulder, exposing a pair of large, transparent ears. "Mr. Tomkins," I said with certainty, and his remaining eye widened in surprise. "Put him down over there, please." The men deposited Tomkins on a stool by the wall and went back to their work. The ship was too short-handed to allow for distraction. Heart beating heavily, I knelt down to examine the wounded leg. He knew who I was, all right. I had seen it in his face when I opened the door. There was a great deal of tension in the leg under my hand. The injury was gory, but not serious, given suitable care. A deep gash scored down the calf of the leg. It had bled substantially, but there were no deep arteries cut. It had been well wrapped with a piece of someone's shirt, and the bleeding had nearly stopped when I unwound the homemade bandage. "How did you do this, Mr. Tomkins?" I asked, standing up and reaching for the bottle of alcohol. He glanced up, his single eye alert and wary.
"Splinter wound, ma'am," he answered in the nasal tones I had heard once before. "A spar broke as I was a-standing on it."
The tip of his tongue stole out, furtively wetting his lower lip.
"I see."
I turned and flipped open the lid of my empty medicine box, pretending to survey the available remedies. I studied him out of the corner of one eye while I tried to think how best to approach him. He was on his guard. Tricking him into revelations or winning his trust were clearly out of the question. My eyes flicked over the tabletop, seeking inspiration, and found it. With a mental apology to the shade of Aesculapius the physician, I picked up the late surgeon's bone saw, a wicked thing, some 18 inches long, of rust-flecked steel. I looked at this thoughtfully, turned, and laid the toothed edge of the instrument gently against the injured leg just above the knee. I smiled charmingly into the seaman's terrified single eye. "Mr. Tomkins," I said, "let us talk frankly." An hour later, able-bodied seaman Tomkins had been restored to his hammock, stitched and bandaged, shaking in every limb, but able-bodied still. For my part, I felt a little shaky as well. Tomkins was, as he had insisted to the press gang in Edinburgh, an agent of Sir Percival Turner. In that capacity, he went about the docks and warehouses of all the shipping ports in the Firth of Forth, from Culross and Donnybristle to Restalrig and Musselburgh, picking up gossip and keeping his beady eye sharp-peeled to catch any evidence of unlawful activity. The attitude of Scots toward English tax laws being what it was, there was no lack of such activity to report. What was done with such reports, though, varied. Small smugglers, caught red-handed with a bottle or two of unbonded rum or whiskey, might be summarily arrested, tried and convicted, and sentenced to anything from penal servitude to transportation, with forfeiture of all their property to the Crown. The bigger fish, though, were reserved to Sir Percival's private judgment. In other words, allowed to pay substantial bribes for the privilege of continuing their operations under the blind eye, here Tomkins laughed sardonically, touching the ruined side of his face, of the King's agents.
"Sir Percival's got ambitions, see?"
While not noticeably relaxed, Tomkins had at least unbent enough to lean forward, one eye narrowing as he gestured in explanation.
"He's in with Dundas and all of them. Everything goes right, and he might have a peerage, not just a knighthood, eh? But that'll take more than money."
One thing that could help was some spectacular demonstration of competence and service to the Crown.
"As in the sort of arrest that might make 'em sit up and take notice, eh? Ooh, that's smarts, missus. You're sure of what you're a-doing of there."
Tomkins squinted dubiously downward to where I was sponging the site of the injury with dilute alcohol. "I'm sure," I said.
Go on, then. I suppose a simple smuggler wouldn't have been good enough, no matter how big.
Evidently not. However, when word had reached Sir Percival that there might just possibly be a major political criminal within his grasp, the old gentleman had nearly blown a gasket with excitement.
But sedition's a harder thing to prove than smuggling, eh? You catch one of the little fish with the goods, and they say not a thing will lead you further on. Idealists, them seditionists,
Tomkins said, shaking his head with disgust.
Never rat on each other, they don't.
So you didn't know who you were looking for? I stood and took one of my catgut sutures from its jar, threading it through a needle. I caught Tomkins' apprehensive look, but did nothing to allay his anxiety. I wanted him anxious and voluble.
No, we didn't know who the big fish was. Not until another of Sir Percival's agents had the luck to tumble to one of Fraser's associates. What gave him the tip, he was Malcolm the printer and told his real name. Then it all came clear, of course.
My heart skipped a beat. Who was the associate? I asked. The names and faces of the six smugglers darted through my mind.
Little fish.
Not idealists, any of them. But to which of them was loyalty no bar?
I don't know. No, it's true, missus, I swear. Ow!
He said frantically as I jabbed the needle under the skin. I'm not trying to hurt you, I assured him, in as false a voice as I could muster. I have to stitch the wound, though.
Ow! Ow! I don't know. To be sure, I don't. I'd tell if I did, as God's my witness.
I'm sure you would, I said, intent on my stitching.
Oh, please, missus, stop. Just for a moment. All I know is it was an Englishman, that's all.
I stopped and stared up at him.
An Englishman? I said blankly. Yes, missus, that's what Sir Percival said.
He looked down at me, tears trembling on the lashes of both his eyes. I took the final stitch as gently as I could and tied the suture knot. Without speaking, I got up, poured a small tot of brandy from my private bottle, and handed it to him. He gulped it gratefully, and seemed much restored in consequence. Whether out of gratitude or sheer relief for the end of the ordeal, he told me the rest of the story. In search of evidence to support a charge of sedition, he had gone to the print shop in Carfax Close.
"I know what happened there," I assured him.
I turned his face toward the light, examining the burn scars. "Is it still painful?"
"No, missus, but it hurt precious bad for some time," he said.
Being incapacitated by his injuries, Tomkins had taken no part in the ambush at Arbroath Cove, but he had heard,
"not direct-like, but I heard, you know," he said, with a shrewd nod of the head,
"what had happened." Sir Percival had given Jamie warning of an ambush to lessen the chances of Jamie's thinking him involved in the affair and possibly revealing the details of their financial arrangements in quarters where such revelations would be detrimental to Sir Percival's interests. At the same time, Sir Percival had learned from the associate, the mysterious Englishman, of the fallback arrangement with the French delivery vessel and had arranged the grave ambush on the beach at Arbroath.
"But what about the customs officer who was killed on the road?"
I asked sharply. I couldn't repress a small shudder at memory of that dreadful face.
"Who did that?"
"There were only 5 men among the smugglers who could possibly have done it, and none of them are Englishmen." Tomkins rubbed a hand over his mouth. He seemed to be debating the wisdom of telling me or not. I picked up the brandy bottle and set it by his elbow.
"Why, I'm much obliged, Mrs. Fraser. You're a true Christian, missus, and so I shall tell anyone who asks."
"Skip the testimonials," I said dryly. "Just tell me what you know about the customs officer." He filled the cup and drained it, sipping slowly. Then, with a sigh of satisfaction, he set it down and licked his lips.
"It wasn't none of the smugglers done him in, missus. It was his own mate."
"What?" I jerked back, startled, but he nodded, blinking his good eye in token of sincerity.
"That's right, missus. There was 2 of them, wasn't there? Well, the one of them had his instructions, didn't he?"
The instructions had been to wait until whatever smugglers escaped the ambush on the beach had reached the road,
whereupon the customs officer was to drop a noose over his partner's head in the dark and strangle him swiftly, then string him up and leave him as evidence of the smuggler's murderous wrath.
"But why?" I said, bewildered and horrified. "What was the point of doing that?"
"Do you not see?" Tomkins looked surprised, as though the logic of the situation should be obvious. "We'd failed to get the evidence from the print shop that would have proved the case of sedition against Fraser, and with the shop burnt to the ground, no possibility of another chance. Nor had we ever caught Fraser red-handed with the goods himself, only some of the small fish who worked for him. One of the other agents thought he'd a clue where the stuff was kept, but something happened to him. Perhaps Fraser caught him or bought him off, for he disappeared one day in November and wasn't heard of again, nor the hiding place for the contraband neither."
"I see." I swallowed, thinking of the man who had accosted me on the stairs of the brothel. What had become of that cask of creme de menthe?
"But, well, I'm telling you, missus, just you wait."
Tompkins raised a monitory hand.
"So, here's Sir Percival, knowing as he's got a rare case, with a man's not only one of the biggest smugglers on the Firth, and the author of some of the most first-rate seditious material it's been my privilege to see, but he's also a pardoned Jacobite traitor, whose name will make the trial a sensation from one end of the kingdom to the other. The only trouble being," he shrugged, "as there's no evidence."
It began to make a hideous sort of sense as Tomkins explained the plan. The murder of a customs officer killed in pursuit of duty wouldn't only make any smuggler arrested for the crime subject to a capital charge, but was the sort of heinous crime that would cause a major public outcry. The matter-of-fact acceptance that smugglers enjoyed from the populace would not protect them in a matter of such callous villainy.
"Your Sir Percival has got the makings of a really first-class son of a bitch," I observed.
Tomkins nodded meditatively, blinking into his cup.
"Well, you're the right of there, missus. I'll not say you're wrong."
"And the customs officer who was killed? I suppose he was just a convenience?" Tomkins sniggered with a fine spray of brandy. His one eye seemed to have some trouble focusing.
"Oh, very convenient, missus. More ways than one. Don't you grieve none on his account. There was a good many folk glad enough to see Tom Oakey swing, and not the least of them Sir Percival."
"I see." I finished fastening the bandage about his calf. It was getting late. I would have to get back to the sick bay soon. "I'd better call someone to take you to your hammock," I said, taking the nearly empty bottle from his unresisting hand. "You should rest your leg for at least 3 days. Tell your officer I said you can't go aloft until I've taken out the stitches."
"I'll do that, missus, and I thank you for your kindness to a poor unfortunate sailor."
Tomkins made an abortive attempt to stand, looking surprised when he failed. I got a hand under his armpit and heaved, getting him on his feet and, he declining my offer to summon him assistance, helped him to the door.
"You needn't worry about Harry Tomkins, missus," he said,
weaving unsteadily into the corridor. He turned and gave me an exaggerated wink.
"Old Harry always ends up all right, no matter what."
Looking at him with his long nose, pink-tipped from liquor, his large transparent ears, and his single sly brown eye, it came to me suddenly what he reminded me of. "When were you born, Mr. Tomkins?" I asked. He blinked for a moment, uncomprehending, but then said,
"The year of our Lord 1713, missus. Why?"
"No reason," I said, and waved him off, watching as he caromed slowly down the corridor, dropping out of sight at the ladder like a bag of oats. I would have to check with Mr. Willoughby to be sure, but at that moment I would have wagered my chemise that 1713 had been a year of the rat. Chapter 48. Moment of Grace. Over the next few days, a routine set in, as it does in even the most desperate circumstances, provided that they continue long enough. The hours after a battle are urgent and chaotic, with men's lives hanging on a second's action. Here, a doctor can be heroic, knowing for certain that the wound just staunched has saved a life, that the quick intervention will save a limb. But in an epidemic, there is none of that. Then come the long days of constant watching and battles fought on the field of germs. And with no weapons suited to that field, it can be no more than a battle of delay, doing the small things that may not help, but must be done, over and over and over again, fighting the invisible enemy of disease in the tenuous hope that the body can be supported long enough to outlast its attacker. To fight disease without medicine is to push against a shadow, a darkness that spreads as inexorably as night. I had been fighting for 9 days, and 46 more men were dead. Still, I rose each day at dawn, splashed water into my grainy eyes, and went once more to the field of war, unarmed with anything save persistence and a barrel of alcohol. There were some victories, but even these left a bitter taste in my mouth. I found the likely source of infection, one of the messmates, a man named Howard. First serving on board as a member of one of the gun crews, Howard had been transferred to galley duty 6 weeks before, the result of an accident with a recoiling gun carriage that had crushed several fingers. Howard had served the gunroom, and the first known case of the disease, taken from the incomplete records of the dead surgeon Mr. Hunter, was one of the Marines who messed there. 4 more cases, all from the gunroom, and then it had begun to spread. As infected but still ambulatory men left the deadly contamination smeared in the ship's heads to be picked up there and passed to the crew at large. Howard's admission that he had seen sickness like this before on other ships where he had served was enough to clinch the matter. However, the cook, shorthanded as everyone else aboard, had declined absolutely to part with a valuable hand, only because of a goddamn female silly notion. Elias couldn't persuade him, and I'd been obliged to summon the captain of the gun crews. Howard had been transferred to galley duty 6 weeks before, the result of an accident with a recoiling gun carriage that had crushed several fingers. Howard had served the gunroom, and the first known case of the disease in bewilderment and impossible to know his name.
Disc 25. Voyager, Disc 26.
As I came up from the galley, the sun was going down into the ocean in a blaze that paved the western sea with gold, like the streets of heaven. I stopped for a moment, just a moment, transfixed by the sight. It had happened many times before, but it always took me by surprise. Always in the midst of great stress, wading waist-deep in trouble and sorrow, as doctors do, I would glance out a window, open a door, look into a face, and there it would be, unexpected and unmistakable, a moment of peace. The light spread from the sky to the ship, and the great horizon was no longer a blank fret of emptiness, but the habitation of joy. For a moment, I lived in the centre of the sun, warm and cleansed, and the smell and sight of sickness fell away. The bitterness lifted from my heart. I never looked for it, gave it no name, yet I knew it always when the gift of peace came. I stood quite still for the moment that it lasted, thinking it strange and not strange that grace should find me here too. Then the light shifted slightly, and the moment passed, leaving me, as it always did, with a lasting echo of its presence. In a reflex of acknowledgement, I crossed myself and went below, my tarnished armour faintly gleaming. Elias Pound died of the typhoid 4 days later. It was a virulent infection. He came to the sick bay, heavy-eyed with fever and wincing at the light. 6 hours later, he was delirious and unable to rise. The next dawn, he pressed his cropped round head against my bosom, called me mother, and died in my arms. I did what had to be done throughout the day, and stood by Captain Leonard at sunset when he read the burial service. The body of Midshipman Pound was consigned to the sea, wrapped in his hammock. I declined the captain's invitation to dinner, and went instead to sit in a remote corner of the afterdeck, next to one of the great guns, where I could look out over the water, showing my face to no one. The sun went down in gold and glory, succeeded by a night of starred velvet, but there was no moment of grace, no peace in either sight for me. As the darkness settled over the ship, all her movements began to slow. I leaned my head against the gun, the polished metal cool under my cheek. A seaman passed me at a fast walk, intent on his duties. And then I was alone. I ached desperately. My head throbbed, my back was stiff, and my feet swollen. But none of these was of any significance, compared to the deeper ache that knotted my heart. Any doctor hates to lose a patient. Death is the enemy. And to lose someone in your care to the clutch of the dark angel is to be vanquished yourself, to feel the rage of betrayal and impotence, beyond the common human grief of loss and the horror of death's finality. I had lost 23 men between dawn and sunset of this day. Elias was only the first. Several had died as I sponged their bodies or held their hands. Others, alone in their hammocks, had died uncomforted, even by a touch, because I couldn't reach them in time. I thought I'd resigned myself to the realities of this time, but knowing, even as I held the twitching body of an 18-year-old seaman as his bowels dissolved in blood and water, that penicillin would have saved most of them, and I had none, was galling as an ulcer eating at my soul. The box of syringes and ampules had been left behind on the Artemis in the pocket of my spare skirt. If I had had it, I couldn't have used it. If I had used it, I could have saved no more than one or two. But even knowing that, I raged at the futility of it all, clenching my teeth until my jaw ached as I went from man to man, armed with nothing but boiled milk and biscuit, and my two empty hands. My mind followed the same dizzying lines my feet had travelled earlier, seeing faces contorted in anguish or smoothing slowly in the slackness of death, but all of them looking at me. I lifted my futile hand and slammed it hard against the rail. I did it again and again, scarcely feeling the sting of the blows, in a frenzy of furious rage and grief. "Stop that!" A voice spoke behind me, and a hand seized my wrist, preventing me from slapping the rail yet again. "Let go!" I struggled, but his grip was too strong. "Stop!" he said again, firmly. His other hand came around my waist, and he pulled me back, away from the rail. "You mustn't do that," he said. "You'll hurt yourself." "I don't bloody care!" I wrenched against his grasp, but then slumped, defeated. What did it matter? He let go of me then, and I turned to find myself facing a man I had never seen before. He wasn't a sailor. While his clothes were crumpled and stale with long wear, they had originally been very fine. The dove-grey coat and waistcoat had been tailored to flatter his slender frame, and the wilted lace at his throat had come from Brussels. "Who the hell are you?" I said in astonishment. I brushed at my wet cheeks, sniffed, and made an instinctive effort to smooth down my hair. I hoped the shadows hid my face. He smiled slightly and handed me a handkerchief, crumpled but clean. "My name is Gray," he said, with a small, courtly bow. "I expect that you must be the famous Mrs. Malcolm, whose heroism Captain Leonard has been so strongly praising." I grimaced at that, and he paused. "I'm sorry," he said. "Have I said something amiss? My apologies, madam. I had no notion of offering you offence." He looked anxious at the thought, and I shook my head. "It's not heroic to watch men die," I said. My words were thick, and I stopped to blow my nose. "I'm just here, that's all. Thank you for the handkerchief." I hesitated, not wanting to hand the used handkerchief back to him, but not wanting simply to pocket it either. He solved the dilemma with a dismissive wave of his hand.
"Might I do anything else for you?"
He hesitated, irresolute.
"A cup of water? Some brandy, perhaps?"
He fumbled in his coat, drawing out a small silver pocket flask engraved with a coat of arms, which he offered to me. I took it with a nod of thanks, and took a swallow deep enough to make me cough. It burned down the back of my throat, but I sipped again, more cautiously this time, and felt it warm me, easing and strengthening. I breathed deeply and drank again. It helped. "Thank you," I said, a little hoarsely, handing back the flask. That seemed somewhat abrupt, and I added, "I'd forgotten that brandy is good to drink. I've been using it to wash people in the sick bay." The statement brought back the events of the day to me with crushing vividness, and I sagged back onto the powder box where I had been sitting. "I take it the plague continues unabated?" he asked quietly. He stood in front of me, the glow of a nearby lantern shining on his dark blonde hair. "Not unabated, no." I closed my eyes, feeling unbearably bleak. There was only one new case today. There were four the day before, and six the day before that. "That sounds hopeful," he observed, "as though you are defeating the disease." I shook my head slowly. It felt dense and heavy as one of the cannonballs piled in the shallow bins by the guns. "No, all we're doing is to stop more men being infected. There isn't a bloody thing I can do for the ones who already have it." "Indeed." He stooped and picked up one of my hands. Surprised, I let him have it. He ran a thumb lightly over the blister where I had burned myself scalding milk and touched my knuckles, reddened and cracked from the constant immersion in alcohol. "You would appear to have been very active, madam, for someone who is doing nothing," he said dryly. "Well, of course I'm doing something," I snapped, yanking my hand back. "It doesn't do any good." "I'm sure," he began. "It doesn't." I slammed my fist on the gun, the noiseless blow seeming to symbolize the pain-filled futility of the day. "Do you know how many men I lost today? 23. I've been on my feet since dawn, elbow deep in filth and vomit, and my clothes stuck to me, and none of it's been any good. I couldn't help. Do you hear me? I couldn't help." His face was turned away, in shadow, but his shoulders were stiff.
"I hear you," he said quietly. "You shame me, madam. I had kept to my cabin at the captain's orders, but I had no idea that the circumstances were such as you describe, or I assure you that I would have come to help, in spite of them."
"Why?" I said blankly. "It isn't your job."
"Is it yours?"
He swung around to face me, and I saw that he was handsome, in his late 30s perhaps, with sensitive, fine-cut features and large blue eyes open in astonishment. "Yes," I said. He studied my face for a moment, and his own expression changed, fading from surprise to thoughtfulness.
"I see."
"No, you don't. But it doesn't matter." I pressed my fingertips hard against my brow in the spot Mr. Willoughby had shown me to relieve headache. "If the captain means you to keep to your cabin, then you likely should. There are enough hands to help in the sick bay. It's just that nothing helps," I ended, dropping my hands. He walked over to the rail, a few feet away from me, and stood looking out over the expanse of dark water, sparked here and there as a random wave caught the starlight.
"I do see," he repeated, as though talking to the waves. "I had thought your distress due only to a woman's natural compassion, but I see it is something quite different."
He paused, hands gripping the rail, an indistinct figure in the starlight.
"I have been a soldier, an officer," he said. "I know what it is to hold men's lives in your hand and to lose them."
I was quiet, and so was he. The usual shipboard sounds went on in the distance, muted by night and the lack of men to make them. At last he sighed and turned toward me again.
"What it comes to, I think, is the knowledge that you are not God."
He paused, then added softly, and the very real regret that you cannot be. I sighed, feeling some of the tension drain out of me. The cool wind lifted the weight of my hair from my neck, and the curling ends drifted across my face, gentle as a touch. "Yes," I said. He hesitated a moment, as though not knowing what to say next, then bent, picked up my hand, and kissed it, very simply, without affectation.
"Good night, Mrs. Malcolm," he said,
and turned away, the sound of his footsteps loud on the deck. He was no more than a few yards past me when a seaman, hurrying by, spotted him and stopped with a cry. It was Jones, one of the stewards.
"My lord, you oughtn't to be out of your cabin, sir. The night air's mortal and the plague loose on board and the captain's orders. Whatever is your servant a-thinking of, sir, to let you walk about like this?"
My acquaintance nodded apologetically.
"Yes, yes, I know. I shouldn't have come up. But I thought that if I stayed in the cabin a moment longer, I should be stifled altogether."
"Better stifled than dead of the bloody flux, sir, and you'll pardon my saying so,"
Jones replied sternly. My acquaintance made no remonstrance to this, but merely murmured something and disappeared in the shadows of the afterdeck. I reached out a hand and grasped Jones by the sleeve as he passed, causing him to start with a wordless yelp of alarm.
"Oh, Mrs. Malcolm," he said,
coming to earth, a bony hand splayed across his chest.
"Christ, I did think you was a ghost, mum, begging your pardon."
"I beg yours," I said politely. "I only wanted to ask, who was the man you were just talking to?"
"Oh, M."
Jones twisted about to look over his shoulder, but the aptly named Mr. Grey had long since vanished.
"Wait, that's Lord John Grey, mum. Him as is the new governor of Jamaica."
He frowned censoriously in the direction taken by my acquaintance.
"He ain't supposed to be up here. The captain's given strict orders he's to stay safe below, out of harm's way. All we need's to come into port with a dead political aboard, and they'll be the devil to pay, mum, save in your presence."
He shook his head disapprovingly, then turned to me with a bob of the head.
"You'll be retiring, mum. Should I bring you down a nice cup of tea and maybe a bit of biscuit?"
"No, thank you, Jones," I said. "I'll go and check the sick bay again before I go to bed. I don't need anything."
"Well, you do, mum, and you just say, any time. Good night to you, mum."
He touched his forelock briefly and hurried off. I stood at the rail, alone for a moment, before going below, drawing in deep breaths of the clean, fresh air. It would be a good many hours yet until dawn. The stars burned bright and clear over my head, and I realized, quite suddenly, that the moment of grace I had wordlessly prayed for had come after all.
"You're right,"
I said at last, aloud, to the sea and sky. "A sunset wouldn't have been enough. Thank you," I added, and went below. Chapter 49 Land Ho. It's true what the sailors say. You can smell land a long time before you see it. Despite the long voyage, the goat pen in the hold was a surprisingly pleasant place. By now the fresh straw had been exhausted, and the goat's hooves clicked restlessly to and fro on bare boards. Still, the heaps of manure were swept up daily and neatly piled in baskets to be heaved overboard, and Anneke Johansson brought dry armloads of hay to the manger each morning. There was a strong smell of goat, but it was a clean animal scent, and quite pleasant by contrast with the stench of unwashed sailors.
"Kuma, kuma, kuma, dur yet," she crooned,
luring a yearling within reach with a twiddled handful of hay. The animal stretched out cautious lips, and was promptly seized by the neck and pulled forward, its head secured under Anarchy's brawny arm.
"Tix, is it?"
I asked, coming forward to help. Anarchy looked up and gave me her broad, gap-toothed smile.
"Guten Morgen, Mrs. Clare," she said. "Ja, Tick, here."
She took the young goat's drooping ear in one hand and turned up the silky edge to show me the blueberry bulge of a blood-gorged tick, burrowed deep in the tender skin. She clutched the goat to hold it still and dug into the ear, pinching the tick viciously between her nails. She pulled it free with a twist, and the goat blatted and kicked, a tiny spot of blood welling from its ear where the tick had been detached. "Wait," I said, when she would have released the animal. She glanced at me, curious, but kept her hold and nodded. I took the bottle of alcohol I wore slung at my belt like a sidearm and poured a few drops on the ear. It was soft and tender, the tiny veins clearly visible beneath the satin skin. The goat's square-pupilled eyes bulged further and its tongue stuck out in agitation as it bleated. "No sore ear," I said in explanation, and Anarchy nodded in approval. Then the goatling was free and went plunging back into the herd to butt its head against its mother's side in a frantic search for milky reassurance. Anarchy looked about for the discarded tick and found it lying on the deck, tiny legs helpless to move its swollen body. She smashed it casually under the heel of her shoe, leaving a tiny dark blotch on the board. "We come to land?" I asked, and she nodded with a wide, happy smile. She waved expansively upward, where sunlight fell through the grating overhead.
"Ja, smell," she said, sniffing vigorously in illustration.
She beamed.
"Land, ja, water, grass, is gut, gut."
"I need to go to land," I said, watching her carefully. "Go quiet, secret, not tell."
"Ah!"
Anarchy's eyes widened, and she looked at me speculatively.
"Not tell captain, ja?"
"Not tell anyone," I said, nodding hard. "You can help." She was quiet for a moment, thinking. A big, placid woman, she reminded me of her own goats, adapting cheerfully to the queer life of shipboard, enjoying the pleasures of hay and warm company, thriving, despite the lurching deck and stuffy shadows of the hold. With that same air of capable adaptation, she looked up at me and nodded calmly.
"Ja, I help."
It was past midday when we anchored off what one of the midshipmen told me was Watling's Island. I looked over the rail with considerable curiosity. This flat island, with its wide white beaches and lines of low palms, had once been called San Salvador. Renamed for the present in honour of a notorious buccaneer of the last century, this dot of land was presumably Christopher Columbus's first sight of the New World. I had the substantial advantage over Columbus of having known for a fact that the land was here, but still I felt a faint echo of the joy and relief that the sailors of those tiny wooden caravels had felt at that first landfall. "Long enough on a rolling ship, and you forget what it is to walk on land. Getting sea legs, they call it. It's a metamorphosis, this leg-getting, like the change from tadpole to frog, a painless shift from one element to another. But the smell and sight of land makes you remember that you were born to the earth, and your feet ache suddenly for the touch of solid ground." The problem at the moment was actually getting my feet on solid ground. Watling's Island was no more than a pause to replenish our severely depleted water supply before the run through the Windward Isles down to Jamaica. It would be at least another week's sail, and the presence of so many invalids aboard requiring vast infusions of liquid had run the great water casks in the hold nearly dry. San Salvador was a small island, but I had learned from careful questioning of my patients that there was a fair amount of shipping traffic through its main port in Coban Town. It might not be the ideal place to escape, but it looked as though there would be little other choice. I had no intention of enjoying the Navy's hospitality on Jamaica, serving as the bait that would lure Jamie to arrest. Starved as the crew was for the sight and feel of land, no one was allowed to go ashore save the watering party, now busy with their casks and sledges up Pigeon Creek, at whose foot we were anchored. One of the marines stood at the head of the gangway, blocking any attempt at leaving. Such members of the crew as were not involved in watering or on watch stood by the rail, talking and joking, or merely gazing at the island, the dream of hope fulfilled. Some way down the deck, I caught sight of a long blonde tail of hair flying in the shore breeze. The governor, too, had emerged from seclusion, pale face upturned to the tropic sun. I would have gone to speak to him, but there was no time. Anarchy had already gone below for the goat. I wiped my hands on my skirt, making my final estimations. It was no more than 200 yards to the thick growth of palms and underbrush. If I could get down the gangway and into the jungle, I thought I had a good chance of getting away. Anxious as he was to be on his way to Jamaica, Captain Leonard was unlikely to waste much time in trying to catch me. And if they did catch me, well, the captain could hardly punish me for trying to leave the ship. I was neither a seaman nor a formal captive after all. The sun shone on Anarchy's blonde head as she made her way carefully up the ladder, a young goat cosily nestled against her wide bosom. A quick glance to see that I was in place, and she headed for the gangway. Anarchy spoke to the sentry in her queer mixture of English and Swedish, pointing to the goat and then ashore, insisting that it must have fresh grass. The marine appeared to understand her, but stood firm.
"No, ma'am," he said respectfully enough. "No one is to go ashore save the watering party. Captain's orders."
Standing just out of sight, I watched as she went on arguing, thrusting her goatling urgently in his face, forcing him a step back, a step to the side, manoeuvring him artfully just far enough that I could slip past behind him. No more than a moment now, he was almost in place. When she had drawn him away from the head of the gangplank, she would drop the goat and cause sufficient confusion in the catching of it that I would have a minute or two to make my escape. I shifted nervously from foot to foot. My feet were bare. It would be easier to run on the sandy beach. The sentry moved, his red-coated back fully turned to me. "A foot more," I thought. "Just a foot more."
"Such a fine day, is it not, Mrs. Malcolm?"
I bit my tongue. "Very fine, Captain Leonard," I said, with some difficulty. My heart seemed to have stopped dead when he spoke. It now resumed beating much faster than usual to make up for lost time. The captain stepped up beside me and looked over the rail, his young face shining with Columbus's joy. Despite my strong desire to push him overboard, I felt myself smile grudgingly at the sight of him.
"This landfall is as much your victory as mine, Mrs. Malcolm," he said. "Without you, I doubt we should ever have brought the porpoise to land."
He very shyly touched my hand, and I smiled again, a little less grudgingly. "I'm sure you would have managed, Captain," I said. "You seem to be a most competent sailor." He laughed and blushed. He had shaved in honour of the land, and his smooth cheeks glowed pink and raw.
"Well, it is mostly the hands, ma'am, I may say they've done nobly. And their efforts, of course, are due in turn to your skill as a physician."
He looked at me, brown eyes shining earnestly.
"Indeed, Mrs. Malcolm, I cannot say what your skill and kindness have meant to us. I mean to say so, too, to the Governor and to Sir Greville, you know, the King's Commissioner on Antigua. I shall write a letter, a most sincere testimonial to you and to your efforts on our behalf. Perhaps it will help."
He dropped his eyes. "Help with what, Captain?" My heart was still beating fast. Captain Leonard bit his lip, then looked up.
"I had not meant to say anything to you, ma'am, but I cannot in honour keep silence. Mrs. Fraser, I know your name, and I know what your husband is."
"Really?" I said, trying to keep control of my own emotions. "What is he?" The boy looked surprised at that.
"Why, ma'am, he's a criminal."
He paled a little.
"You mean you didn't know?"
"Yes, I knew that," I said dryly. "Why are you telling me, though?" He licked his lips, but met my eyes bravely enough.
"When I discovered your husband's identity, I wrote it in the ship's log. I regret that action now, but it is too late. The information is official. Once I reach Jamaica, I must report his name and destination to the authorities there, and likewise to the commander at the naval barracks on Antigua. He will be taken when the Artemis docks."
He swallowed.
"And if he's taken?"
"He'll be hanged," I said, finishing what he could not. The boy nodded, wordless. His mouth opened and closed, seeking words.
"I've seen men hanged," he said at last. "Mrs. Fraser, I..."
He stopped then, fighting for control, and found it. He drew himself up straight and looked at me straight on, the joy of his landing drowned in sudden misery.
"I am sorry," he said softly. "I cannot ask you to forgive me. I can only say that I am most terribly sorry."
He turned on his heel and walked away. Directly before him stood Anarchy Johansson and her goat, still in heated conversation with the sentry.
"What is this?" Captain Leonard demanded angrily. "Remove this animal from the deck at once. Mr. Holford, what are you thinking of?"
Anarchy's eyes flicked from the captain to my face, instantly divining what had gone wrong. She stood still, head bowed to the captain's scolding, then marched away toward the hatchway to the goat's hold, clutching her yearling. As she passed, one big blue eye winked solemnly. We would try again. But how? Racked by guilt and bedeviled by contrary winds, Captain Leonard avoided me, seeking refuge on his quarterdeck as we made our cautious way past Ackling Island and Samana Cay. The weather aided him in this evasion. It stayed bright, but with odd light breezes alternating with sudden gusts, so that constant adjustment of the sails was required. No easy task in a ship so short-handed. It was 4 days later, as we shifted course to enter the Caicos Passage, that a sudden booming gust of wind struck the ship out of nowhere, catching her ill-rigged and unprepared. I was on deck when the gust struck. There was a sudden whoosh that sent my skirts billowing and propelled me flying down the deck, followed by a sharp, loud crack somewhere overhead. I crashed head-on into Ramsdell Hodges, one of the forecastle crew, and we whirled together in a mad pirouette before falling entangled to the deck. There was confusion all around, with hands running and orders shouted. I sat up, trying to collect my scattered wits. "What is it?" I demanded of Hodges, who staggered to his feet and reached down to lift me up. "What's happened?"
"The fucking mainmast split," he said succinctly. "Saving your presence, ma'am, but it has. And now there'll be hell to pay."
The Porpoise limped slowly south, not daring to risk the banks and shoals of the passage without a mainmast. Instead, Captain Leonard put in for repairs at the nearest convenient anchorage, Bottle Creek, on the shore of North Caicos Island. This time we were allowed ashore, but no great good did it do me. Tiny and dry, with few sources of fresh water, the Turks and Caicos provided little more than numerous tiny bays that might shelter passing ships caught in storms. And the idea of hiding on a foodless, waterless island, waiting for a convenient hurricane to blow me a ship, didn't appeal. To Anarchy, though, our change of course suggested a new plan.
"I know this island," she said, nodding wisely. "We go round now. Grand Turk, Mouchoir, not Caicos."
I looked askance, and she squatted, drawing with a blunt forefinger in the yellow sand of the beach.
"See? Caicos Passage," she said,
sketching a pair of lines. At the top, between the lines, she sketched the small triangle of a sail.
"Go through," she said,
indicating the Caicos Passage.
"But mast is gone. Now."
She quickly drew several irregular circles to the right of the passage.
"North Caicos, South Caicos, Caicos, Grand Turk," she said,
stabbing a finger at each circle in turn.
"Go round now, reefs, Mouchoir."
And she drew another pair of lines, indicating a passage to the southeast of Grand Turk Island.
"Mouchoir Passage?"
I had heard the sailors mention it, but had no idea how it applied to my potential escape from the Porpoise. Anarchy nodded, beaming, then drew a long wavy line some way below her previous illustrations. She pointed at it proudly.
"Hispaniola, San Domingue. Big island. Is there towns? Lots ships."
I raised my eyebrows, still baffled. She sighed, seeing that I didn't understand. She thought for a moment, then stood up, dusting her heavy thighs. We had been gathering whelks from the rocks in a shallow pan. She seized this, dumped out the whelks, and filled it with seawater. Then, laying it on the sand, she motioned me to watch. She stirred the water carefully in a circular motion, then lifted her finger out, stained dark with the purple blood of the whelks. The water continued to move, swirling past the tin sides. Anarchy pulled a thread from the ravelling hem of her skirt, bit off a short piece and spat it into the water. It floated, following the swirl of the water in lazy circles round the pan.
"You," she said, pointing at it. "Water, move you."
She pointed back to her drawing in the sand. A new triangle in the mouchoir passage. A line curving from the tiny sail down to the left, indicating the ship's course. And now, the blue thread representing me, rescued from its immersion. She placed it by the tiny sail representing the porpoise, then dragged it off down the passage toward the coast of Hispaniola.
"Jump," she said simply.
"You're crazy," I said in horror. She chuckled in deep satisfaction at my understanding.
"Yeah," she said, "but it work. Water move you."
She pointed to the end of the mouchoir passage to the coast of Hispaniola and stirred the water in the pan once more. We stood side by side, watching the ripples of her manufactured current die away. Anarchy glanced thoughtfully sideways at me.
"You try not drown, yeah?"
I took a deep breath and brushed the hair out of my eyes. "Yeah," I said, "I'll try." Chapter 50. I Meet a Priest. The sea was remarkably warm, as seas go, and like a warm bath as compared to the icy surf off Scotland. On the other hand, it was extremely wet. After 2 or 3 hours of immersion, my feet were numb, and my fingers chilled where they gripped the ropes of my makeshift life preserver, made of 2 empty casks. The gunner's wife was as good as her word, though. The long, dim shape I had glimpsed from the porpoise grew steadily nearer, its low hills dark as black velvet against a silver sky. Hispaniola. Haiti. I had no way of telling time, and yet 2 months on shipboard, with its constant bells and watch changes, had given me a rough feeling for the passage of the night hours. I thought it must have been near midnight when I left the porpoise. Now it was likely near 4 a.m, and still over a mile to the shore. Ocean currents are strong, but they take their time. Worn out from work and worry, I twisted the rope awkwardly about one wrist to prevent my slipping out of the harness, laid my forehead on one cask, and drifted off to sleep with the scent of rum strong in my nostrils. The brush of something solid beneath my feet woke me to an opal dawn, the sea and sky both glowing with the colours found inside a shell. With my feet planted in cold sand, I could feel the strength of the current flowing past me, tugging on the casks. I disentangled myself from the rope harness and, with considerable relief, let the unwieldy things go bobbing toward the shore. There were deep red indentations on my shoulders. The wrist I had twisted through the wet rope was rubbed raw. I was chilled, exhausted, and very thirsty, and my legs were rubbery as boiled squid. On the other hand, the sea behind me was empty, the porpoise nowhere in sight. I had escaped. Now, all that remained to be done was to get ashore, find water, find some means of quick transport to Jamaica, and find Jamie and the Artemis, preferably before the Royal Navy did. I thought I could just about manage the first item on the agenda. Such little as I knew of the Caribbean from postcards and tourist brochures had led me to think in terms of white sand beaches and crystal lagoons. In fact, prevailing conditions ran more toward a lot of dense and ugly vegetation, embedded in extremely sticky, dark brown mud. The thick bush-like plants must be mangroves. They stretched as far as I could see in either direction. There was no alternative but to clamber through them. Their roots rose out of the mud in big loops like croquet wickets, which I tripped over regularly, and the pale, smooth grey twigs grew in bunches like finger bones, snatching at my hair as I passed. Squads of tiny purple crabs ran off in profound agitation at my approach. My feet sank into the mud to the ankles, and I thought better of putting on my shoes, wet as they were. I rolled them up in my wet skirt, curtling it up above my knees, and took out the fish knife Anarchy had given me, just in case. I saw nothing threatening, but felt better with a weapon in my hand. The rising sun on my shoulders at first was welcome as it thawed my chilled flesh and dried my clothes. Within an hour, though, I wished that it would go behind a cloud. I was sweating heavily as the sun rose higher, caked to the knees with drying mud and growing thirstier by the moment. I tried to see how far the mangroves extended, but they rose above my head, and tossing waves of narrow grey-green leaves were all I could see. "The whole bloody island can't be mangroves," I muttered, slogging on. "There has to be solid land somewhere." And water, I hoped. A noise like a small cannon going off nearby startled me so that I dropped the fish knife. I groped frantically in the mud for it, then dived forward onto my face as something large whizzed past my head, missing me by inches. There was a loud rattling of leaves, and then a sort of conversational sounding quack. "What?" I croaked. I sat up cautiously, knife in one hand, and wiped the wet, muddy curls out of my face with the other. 6 feet away, a large black bird was sitting on a mangrove, regarding me with a critical eye. He bent his head, delicately preening his sleek black feathers, as though to contrast his immaculate appearance with my own dishevelment. "Well, la-di-da," I said sarcastically. "You've got wings, mate." The bird stopped preening and eyed me censoriously. Then he lifted his beak into the air, puffed his chest, and as though to further establish his sartorial superiority, suddenly inflated a large pouch of brilliant red skin that ran from the base of his neck halfway down his body. "Boom," he said, repeating the cannon-like noise that had startled me before. It startled me again, but not so much. "Don't do that," I said irritably. Paying no attention, the bird slowly flapped its wings, settled back on its branch, and boomed again. There was a sudden harsh cry from above, and with a loud flapping of wings, two more large blackbirds plopped down, landing in a mangrove a few feet away. Encouraged by the audience, the first bird went on booming at regular intervals, the skin of his pouch flaming with excitement. Within moments, three more black shapes had appeared overhead. I was reasonably sure they weren't vultures, but I still wasn't inclined to stay. I had miles to go before I slept, or found Jamie. The chances of finding him in time was something I preferred not to dwell on. A half hour later, I had made so little progress that I could still hear the intermittent booming of my fastidious acquaintance, now joined by a number of similarly vocal friends. Panting with exertion, I picked a thickish root and sat down to rest. My lips were cracked and dry, and the thought of water was occupying my mind to the exclusion of virtually everything else, even Jamie. I'd been struggling through the mangroves for what seemed like forever, yet I could still hear the sound of the ocean. In fact, the tide must have been following me, for as I sat, a thin sheet of foaming, dirty seawater came purling through the mangrove roots to touch my toes briefly before receding. "Water, water everywhere," I said ruefully, watching it, "nor any drop to drink." A small movement on the damp mud caught my eye. Bending down, I saw several small fishes, of a sort I'd never seen before. So far from flopping about, gasping for breath, these fish were sitting upright, propped on their pectoral fins, looking as though the fact that they were out of water was of no concern at all. Fascinated, I bent closer to inspect them. One or two shifted on their fins, but they seemed not to mind being looked at. They goggled solemnly back at me, eyes bulging. It was only as I looked closer that I realized that the goggling appearance was caused by the fact that each fish appeared to have four eyes, not two. I stared at one for a long minute, feeling the sweat trickle down between my breasts. "Either I'm hallucinating," I told it conversationally, "or you are." The fish didn't answer, but hopped suddenly, landing on a branch several inches above the ground. Perhaps it sensed something, for a moment later another wave washed through, this one splashing up to my ankles. A sudden welcome coolness fell.